My name is Nick Holloway. I'm not sick. I'm not crazy, but I am invisible. I'm making this tape because in a few hours I could be dead. This is my last chance. I've got a hell of a story to tell.
Welcome to the Rewind Movie Podcast. The following review will contain spoilers and may contain strong language.
You know, it's always difficult with people like this. No strong emotional ties, no political beliefs, no particular interests. Matter of fact, when you think about it, the man has the perfect profile. He was invisible before he was invisible.
As part of our throwback series, today we'll be discussing Memoirs of an Invisible Man, starring Chevy Chase, Daryl Hannah, and Sam Neill, directed by John Carpenter. Hello and welcome to the Rewind Movie Podcast. It's Gally, the podcaster who is in a state of molecular flux from Glasgow.
Don't tell anyone I cried. It's Devlin in London.
What are we doing? I hope it's foreplay. It's Patrick from London.
Welcome back, guys, and we're doing a throwback episode, and this one is Devlin's choice.
It is. It's very nice to speak to you all again. I hope that this was an enjoyable experience for you, although we'll find out in the next hour and a half to 2 hours whether you now hate me.
Here's a question, Devlin. I think me and Patrick both probably wanted this one answering when we were...
Why, Devlin? Why?
Yeah, why? Why, out of all of John Carpenter's oeuvre, would you pick Memoirs of an Invisible Man?
Well, I picked it because I guess like the main criteria we talk about for when we're looking at these films is a film that you watched a lot or you just, you know... You either remember very, very, very well from childhood or a film that had some effect on you during childhood. And for whatever reason, I watched this film a lot as a kid. As ever with these things, chances are the reason why it was on TV so much was because it was a bit of a financial flop. And studios like to ditch that sort of stuff onto TV to try and make back some revenue. Also, the rights are cheaper, so... It's kind of a win-win. It means that BBC Two get to clog up the schedules with the same old films over and over again for not very much money. And when I watched it as a kid, I didn't know who John Carpenter was, really. Nor did I really think of this as a John Carpenter film. It was only much later that I became a big fan of Carpenter's work that I realized that this film that I used to really like when I was... eight, nine, maybe, was one of Johnny C's. If I were to sit here and want to chat with you guys about, I don't know, The Thing or Big Trouble in Little China or Halloween or fucking Escape from New York, any of these, I think I would struggle to be impartial or really have much of anything to say beyond and this bit happened and that was Ace too. It could be like a bit of a hagiography. So I find the latter part of John Carpenter's career almost more fascinating than the early part.
Yeah, we watched a lot of those later films, didn't we? I remember, did we watch Ghost of Mars together?
We did.
I think I remember at uni watching that. Some Statham, some very early Statham.
The brief shining moment for Natasha Henstridge. She got her stuff in. Well, she could.
She's vacuous in that.
Ice Cube, who is, of course, you know, Ice Cube's, he's got such a great career that he can just like dip in and out of these sort of catastrophes, and he does the same thing in every single film. But you know, when it works, it works. When it doesn't, he can just shrug it off because he's Ice Cube. So yeah, it's an interesting one. This is basically the first time that John Carpenter didn't present the film as a John Carpenter movie. This was purely a director for hire gig. Everything from Assault on Precinct 13 really onwards, the streak that he went on throughout the 1980s is sort of pretty legendary as far as having very few flaws in it. It's kind of like, I don't know, like The Simpsons seasons 2 through 8, with like with Darkstar being The Simpsons season 1, which is the weird one that you still like, even though it's dead odd.
Darkstar's great.
Yeah, it is. It's great. But it's also, it's a bit of an outlier in, you know, it doesn't have the...
Was he a student, though, when he did Darkstar?
He was, yeah.
That was it's one of the only films that...
He was, I don't know whether he was a student of, but he was certainly at USC at the same time that Irving Kirshner was on the staff there, and he would have been not too far removed from George Lucas's era of USC. So they were roughly contemporaries. Darkstar was him and Dan O'Bannon putting this thing together, but Assault on Precinct 13 was kind of the first, you know, the first time he made these super gritty, indulging his Howard Hawks fascination. And so, yeah, so that run that he was on very much came to an abrupt end at the end of the 80s. You would say They Live is like, you know, the last of the Carpenter classics. Although looking back across like that streak of films, the vast majority of them didn't do particularly well.
So when did John Carpenter sort of get reappraised as, actually, you know what, here's one of the most underrated directors in American cinema?
You can't move these days for Carpenter influence. You look back at super obvious ones like The Guest or everything Nicholas Winding Refn does. Like his fingerprints are all over modern cinema. I think that was probably what created the reappraisal, which is filmmakers just coming out and showing really obvious influence from his films. Because I guess, what was Ghosts of Mars was like 2001. And at that point, he was in the process of being like washed up. He was coming off Escape from LA, which just has that... It's impossible to think about Escape from LA without thinking about the surfing scene in it.
I think I came to Compton quite late though myself. Because the first film I'm aware of seeing of his in like in chronological order of when I saw them was Village of the Damned.
I
remember watching that at home and my mum and dad really enjoying it. And then my dad going on to then just love Snake Plissken and Escape from LA and him going. So I'm wondering if mum and dad even were late to it as well. And Village of the Damned kicked it off because dad loved Escape from LA. And then I loved Escape from LA at that point. And I don't know, I didn't really get into Carpenter films till I was much older, till I was 18 or maybe when I started uni. And I'm wondering if it's because of you guys. Oh, no, The Thing. My dad was a big fan of The Thing as well.
I wonder if the change in media as in from VHS to DVD as well maybe had a bit of a...
I think that's what did it for me.
It probably would have served him really well because... One of his big calling cards, there's sort of two things which has become really recognizable. One is the awesome synthesizer scores, and the other is that beautiful use of that big widescreen frame with all the, you know, the lens flare flashing across it and like really filling out that frame. And when you're watching it on a videotape on a 4x4:3 television, or even if you're watching like some old pan and scan DVD where they've cropped out all of the detail and stuff, you don't really get to see. I remember going to a screening of The Thing. Probably it was when I was living back in Darlington, so I was probably looking at, I don't know, like 2008 maybe, 2007 2008. Me and Matt, we went to Middlesbrough to see it, and even though I'd seen it a few times, like there's just something about seeing that craftsmanship on that scale is just kind of mind blowing.
Oh, sorry, Patrick.
And I suppose, so the audience know, I think your favorite is Big Trouble in Little China, right, Devin?
Mine, it fluctuates, but yeah, I would say it's the one that I enjoy watching
it's
the most.
It's the one I'm aware of you referring to and dressing up as the most. And
I have dressed as Jack.
Can you take us to that bar in Glasgow with the... mural on the
There's a photo of me doing the little hand gesture outside it. Yeah, I'm very proud of that one. I love John Carpenter stuff, but I feel like you can glean a lot about what works for John Carpenter by looking at what doesn't work for John Carpenter. And also, like I say, this is a film that I really liked. So sort of go back and watch it with you guys and have a chat about it and see whether, because you guys weren't familiar with this. You'd never seen it.
Hadn't seen it. Right. Never seen it.
Gals?
So Sam Neill looms large in my memory. So once Jurassic Park comes out a year later, I pretty much subsume every Sam Neill film ever, to the point where I think I watched Bicentennial Man about 4 times, even though it's dreadful.
For 4 times, yeah, to watch the Sam same Neill's film?
Like, that was just my thing, dude. I was just a very, very impulsive kind of kid, okay, when it came down to the films. And I remember Memoirs of an Invisible Man. What I would say, Devin, is treat my viewing of this now as I barely remembered anything about the film. I think I had scanty guesses at the end of the Terminator episode where I was sort of just trying to pull things out of the memory. But Sam Neill, a beach house, Chevy Chase is all I could actually remember. So watching this again was like watching it with fresh eyes, because it's got to be over 20 years for me since I've seen this film.
Because, yeah, it is a strange one. There's some stuff, as we get into it, I think that we can find some stuff in there that you can see where John Carpenter is engaged, and there's some interesting parallels with other films of his. And then there are other parts where maybe you don't really get the impression that he's entirely meshing with the project. So it's an interesting one.
Just before, like, something I learned, and I don't know whether this has ever been a trope of Carpenter, Devlin, because you are, I count you as the Carpenter expert here, but this was a bit of a paycheck film for him. I think
he needed it.
He wasn't really that interested, but made it. And it was Ivan Reitman who was up for it.
Yes.
To start.
Yeah. Yeah. So the project was basically shepherded through by Chevy Chase. He was the one who, I don't know whether he optioned the rights for the film or whether he encouraged the studio to option the rights for the film. But if you look at the...
It was a bit of both, I think. Like, he was using his name to get it made because he wanted to do something a bit more serious, which was really interesting, having watched it.
If you look at the credits right at the start of the film, it calls it a Cornelius production, and that is Chevy Chase's real first name. Because Chevy Chase actually a town in... where is it? I think it's in, like, Maryland? It's right next to where the headquarters of the company I work for is. That's how I know it, because I got an email from somebody and the address was Chevy Chase. I was like, fuck off. And then it turns out it's actually a town. I didn't write fuck off.
He knew we were talking about him.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's very much a Chevy Chase production, and it was... He optioned it, I think, back in like 1986 or 87.
Right.
At which point it would have made all the sense in the world to go to Ivan Reitman, because Ivan Reitman was 2 years removed from like the biggest hit. Yeah. They got William Goldman in to script it. This was pre Princess Bride William Goldman, so he was in a bit of a wilderness years thing, because he'd written his memoirs. And he'd slagged a bunch of people off and nobody would hire him.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty ballsy
move.
He's
such a legend.
He is. He and Chevy, he turned in a draft. Chevy Chase said, this is basically Clark Griswold turns invisible. This is too comedic. I don't want to do this. William Goldman tried to do some rewrites on it, but clashed with Chevy Chase, as most people tended to do.
Wow.
And Goldman's response was, I'm too old and too rich for this shit. And he left.
Brilliant.
And then Ivan Reitman walked because he was happy with the script as it was. So Chevy Chase brought in two new writers. I wrote their name down because I'd never heard of them. One was called
Dana Olsen.
Who wrote The Burbs.
And Robert Collector.
Which is great. Dana Olsen wrote The Burbs.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Robert Collector, however, the only credit
I also wrote Inspector Gadget, though.
Oh, Jesus.
Well,
Dana Olsen also wrote the Broderick Inspector Gadget. So, you know, Goldman isn't free either. He wrote The Ghost and The Darkness. So everyone has a has a little blip.
Oh, as if you didn't enjoy The Ghost and The Darkness.
Bloody hell.
And the other writer is this guy, Robert Collector, and I saw on his IMDb that he'd written Red Heat, and I was like, oh, fuck, Red Heat. And it's not that Red Heat. It's a weird film from 1985 starring Linda Blair
It's a blue movie.
Yeah, just a strange post-exorcist.
Whenever I watch any film and I see multiple production companies and then followed by multiple screenwriters, I'm already like, uh-oh, we might be watching a bit.
I mean, this was only three, so I guess what you've got is, you know, Golden was the guy who came up with the majority of the plot structure, probably, and then the two writers were brought in. Two writers who at the time would have been a lot less experienced, less clout, maybe more likely to kind of make the changes that Chevy would have wanted.
Because he wanted a serious film, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
I've always felt that Will Ferrell reminds me of Chevy Chase. It's interesting that when I read he wanted a serious film, and then, you know, like, I suppose Saturday Night Live actors, they do this a lot, like... Jim Carrey went serious, Man on the Moon. Yeah. And
Robin Williams.
Yeah. Well, Bicentennial Man.
Even modern comedians like Steve Carell.
But like, it reminded me of Will Ferrell, Stranger Than Fiction. It reminded me of the performance in that and his move.
Kind of the closest analogue to Chevy Chase in terms of that era, coming out of Saturday Night Live, having quite a defined persona, finding success in like mainstream comedy films and kind of chafing against it would be like Bill Murray, who he knew, worked with, and fucking hated.
Did he really?
Yeah, they got in a fist fight backstage at Saturday Night Live.
We haven't got into the plot of this,
blimey,
but the parallels between Memoirs of an Invisible Man and a year later Groundhog Day, to me it felt like one of the same, but one nailed it and one did not. Which one? Well, listen and see.
So the era that he actually optioned the book was like 86, so his stock would have been very high at that point. He would have been coming off the first two Vacation movies and Fletch was the biggest hit, and I think Fletch and the character that he played in Fletch looms very, very, very large over this film, possibly in a way that kind of dilutes what he was maybe going for. But sort of around that time, so Bill Murray in 1985, he made The Razor's Edge, which I'd literally just sat through for the first time this week because I wanted to watch it to kind of get a bit of a comparison. Fuck me, that took me 3 days to finish.
Wow.
Because it's not good. is a Bill Murray passion project, and you know, he did the same. He only did Ghostbusters on the proviso that Columbia Pictures would put up the money for The Razor's Edge for him, and it's based on a Somerset Maugham novel, and it's set in the First World War, and he gets to learn all of India's knowledge in the space of one edit, and he gets to read nothing but, you know, literature and philosophy, and it's a real ego trip, and I think this film has the same kind of basis.
It's got the same smell, hasn't it? Yeah. You know, you said about Fletch, but look at those late 80s for Chase. He's basically either in films where his mates have cast him, or he's doing a sequel to a film that's been successful. The Lampoons, Fletch had a sequel,
yep.
Caddyshack 2. Yep. So actually, when he's doing this, I'm not to say that this is his last hurrah, but... he's lucky that he's even a star in this film, because at this point he's just got Clark Griswold and Fletch, and that's it. He's been
and
an
he was one of
comedy films,
one of the three amigos.
Yeah, but one of the three amigos, of which Steve Martin is way better. So it's just I'm not a big fan of Chevy Chase, and really the only time I've ever thought that he's ever worked was in the National Lampoon's films, and that's because he's playing a fool. But every time he plays the sort of Bill Murray sarcastic smartest man in the room stuff, he's not charming enough to make me like him. He ends up just being obnoxious, as opposed to Bill Murray, who's got this weird like effect where he just, even though he's actually putting you down, you're like, oh yeah, but you're so witty. I mean, he'd be a great politician, Bill Murray, if he wanted to ever do it.
Yeah. Well, he's detached. He's more detached than ironic, and you don't get the feeling that Chevy Chase is that same. He can't really pull off that level of detachment, because you get the impression that he is trying to alpha every situation, like he is trying to kind of I mean, most people who worked with him in that kind of era, and also up until very recently, I mean, he left the very terrific Community under a bit of a cloud, because he and the showrunner Dan Harmon used to clash all the time. He was great in Community because he was legitimately an arsehole, and he helped to keep that show kind of feeling. It gave it like a real edge that he wouldn't have had otherwise. It might have collapsed into a bit of a sort of self-congratulatory kind of self-aware sitcom of, you know, hugs and tweeness, but he's in it and he's a prick, and it really works. Like the balance of the show is off when he's not there. So I have seen Chevy in person.
Have you?
Yeah, I have. My brother's brother-in-law, super nice guy, he wanted to go see an evening with Chevy Chase at the Hammersmith Apollo of all places, which is massive. And it was a sellout, so it was a big deal. And they bring him out, and most people say that, you know, they wheel him out, and we're sitting in the audience. I'd never been to anything like this, like these evenings with, because I'm not particularly interested, but I don't know. I guess it was Chevy Chase, and I have a lot of kind of leftover fond memories of really liking his films when I was a kid, including this one. Really, honestly, this is probably the first film that I remember watching Chevy Chase in a lot. So it's between this and Christmas Vacation, really. And so we wondered what the setup was going to be. And then we're like, okay, well, I assume they'll bring out an interviewer because he's not just going to stand there and monologue. And they did bring out an interviewer. They brought out disgraced radio DJ and creator of the UKIP Calypso, Mike Reed.
Shit.
Who is a fucking fossil. And they wheel him out. They wheel them both out. And this shit show starts almost immediately. Chevy Chase weirdly comes out of the whole thing looking quite nice because he's just confused. Because he doesn't know who Mike Reed is.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's no way he knows who Frank Butcher is.
Oh no, not that Mike Reed.
Oh shit, not that Mike Reed. Oh no.
All right, I would have fucking loved it. I'm afraid he's long dead, Gally. No, Frank Butcher confused as fuck on stage at the Hammersmith Apollo, just like vaguely remembering who Chevy Chase is would be amazing, and I would have been very happy.
But the other Mike Reed,
but
Mike Reed.
Yeah, no, the bad Mike Reed, the awful one. So Mike Reed comes out, and as soon as they say, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Reed," and every like 2/3 of the audience just go, "What the fuck?" Like, and he comes out.
Wow.
And it just wasn't publicized. And then so he comes out, and it becomes very quickly aware. We become very aware that Mike Reed doesn't know how to host anything. Mike Reed loves the sound of Mike Reed's voice, and Mike Reed goes full Partridge immediately. instead of asking him about anything, he starts asking about like his upbringing. He starts asking him about his family tree, like his ancestors, and apparently like a great great granddad was the captain of a ship. And he said, when you think about these guys in your family, do you feel proud? So what the fuck are you talking about? What is a man's some dude who he never met who died 200 years before he was born? Why would he be proud of him? he barely asks him about any of the films. They do talk about tennis for a really long time.
Oh my!
Like an excruciatingly long time. And because I know Galsy wanted to talk about tennis, and there you go. There's your connection. Okay. Chevy Chase loves tennis. Together. Chevy Chase barely remembers the films that he was in. Mike Reed isn't helping. He keeps asking about some real bullshit. The best bit is
Frank Butcher would have been better.
So towards the end of the interview, he just starts talking about all of his divorces. Mike Reed starts talking about all Chevy Chase's divorces and asking him about, you know, you've been married a lot of times, haven't you? And they've all left you. And then he talks about his cocaine habit, which
this is not what the audience wanted.
He comes out of it quite humble. He's like, yeah, and you know, I felt like I was, you know, the king shit, and so yeah, that didn't help. He said it gave him a towering ego that he still has, but and then Mike Reed says, because you know we've got a lot of drugs problems here in London. do you have a message out there for the kids? It's like, what the fuck?
What the hell is this? Right.
Why is a 15-year-old in Streatham gives a shit what Chevy Chase reckons because he once did some coke in the 80s in Hollywood. And then he pulled out a guitar and tried to do one of the songs from the Three Amigos that Chevy Chase could not remember.
I thought you were going to say a gun.
No, he pulled out, he went Brent and he pulled out the guitar. Starts playing it. Chevy Chase doesn't remember the lyrics because it was a film that came out in 1990 or whatever. Mike Reed also doesn't know the lyrics, and nobody knows the lyrics. But he won't stop playing it. And then eventually they open the audience, they open the floor to whoever wants to ask a question. And instead of a question, one guy just yelled, "Mike Reed, you're a twat."
Well,
and he got the biggest cheer of the night. And then Mike Reed wrapped it up 15 minutes early because he was sad.
Oh, my God.
Thank you, Springdon. There will be no encore. And that was us. That was my evening with Chevy Chase. That made like the entertainment news across the world. I remember reading about this on like the AV Club and all these websites. They're like, Chevy Chase has famously disastrous interview, and it's not even his fault.
I'm a bit gobsmacked.
Well, Devlin, we've teased it long enough. Would you mind giving us the plot of Memoirs of an Invisible Man?
Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Sardonic stock analyst Nick Holloway, Chevy Chase, suffers a freak accident when he takes a hungover nap in the offices of a scientific foundation that then becomes invisible. Similarly afflicted, he falls into the clutches of CIA operative David Jenkins, Sam Neill, who intends to use Nick as the ultimate infiltration weapon. Scarpering, Nick escapes San Francisco to a friend's beach house, where chance brings him back in contact with the beautiful stranger, Daryl Hannah, he met the night before his fateful invisibling, which is a word. Their feelings for each other develop as they go on the run from an increasingly deranged Jenkins and his agents, resulting in some genuinely regrettable blackface.
Oh, God.
I don't know what you guys were expecting with the film when it opened up, but what did you make of the opening sequence?
Just to say it from the very beginning, I found the film was a little uneven, and I thought it was a really good, like you said, Hitchcockian opener and a thriller kind of it was really interesting, a cool special effect, the chewing gum, and it was a really, you know, it's a catchy opening. It definitely gets your attention. Did its job very
well. Do they call that in media res? Is that what you call it when you come into a film while it's kind of in action? Is that the phrase? I might be using it wrong.
In media res, practice of beginning an epic or other narrative by plunging into a crucial situation that is part of a related chain of events. The situation is an extension of previous events and will be developed in later action. It's very good, Devlin.
Hey, I read a book once.
Twice. We all know you're a fucking nerd. So.
It set up a film that I was really, really game for. I think Patrick is absolutely right. This Hitchcockian thriller that we're expecting. I love the reference to Double Indemnity with the him giving a memoir and a videotape, doing the almost like a confessional. And he's already on the run, the agent. So everything seems to be set up for what I think is going to be a North by Northwest or a, you know, To Catch a Thief. And then I think Patrick said it in a very diplomatic way. The film is quite uneven, but this particular opening also feels a very John Carpenter-y because I think
really
it looks like a John Carpenter film with the contrast maybe just slightly dialed up. So we haven't got as many deeper darks as we might normally see. But other than that, it looks like a John Carpenter film. I'm fully game in this opening sequence, and I love the optical effects with the chewing gum being animated.
It's incredible, isn't it?
And it's like a tease, isn't it? It's like a tease because obviously Carpenter's withholding the more technological effects for later on in the film.
Do you reckon it's literally just stop frame animation?
It looks like it is. It's very good stop frame animation, especially when the chewing gum actually bursts, because that looks hyper real.
Yeah.
But it's clever. It's very clever.
And I love the score. I mean, I know when we talk about Carpenter films, we're usually talking about his scores, but this one was by Shirley Walker, who I guess her biggest claim to fame was Batman the Animated Series. She used to do the music for that, which is cool because it's very unusual to get a female composer sole credit on a film of this size. And
did you read the IMDb trivia, which obviously we have to take with a pinch of salt, that said that this was the first female scored film,
really?
Like solely? Yeah, I hope not, because that is depressing, because it's 1992. But either way, I really like the score. It was it's quite bombastic, but it's also got the mood of a film noir as well. And I think it does a lot of the heavy lifting during some of the emotional sequences later on in the film. It kind of sells the romance.
And it kind of sells the those little, just around the edges, it's got that little, those like horror hints, especially when you get the big wide shot of the foundation as it's in flux and it's going to disappear.
Do you think they opened with this section though, and with the visual effect, because at the time it was quite groundbreaking and I think a lot of people wanted to be hooked. Well, they knew that the audience would have wanted to be hooked by that at the beginning, because that's what they come for more than anything.
Yeah, I think that's. I mean, you've got to make a big pitch to keep people in their seats.
Well, I also think it's probably trying to tell the audience straight away this is not going to be Chevy Chase, Clark Griswold. He's not making gags as such in this opening sequence, and I do wonder if that threw people a little bit, because I'm sure they probably would have been expecting a screwball comedy.
The advertising, especially the trailer, leans really heavy, doesn't it?
Makes it look like it's going to be a full comedy.
Don't want the comedy.
Whereas there's really more of that action.
He's still quite dry, though, his performance. It's very dry.
I like the story device with him filming the memoirs, but I do kind of feel like it's apropos of nothing in the end.
Yeah,
that's just being thing. It should either be used as some form of metaphor or something, but by the end, it's literally just a major videotape. It's the classic thing
of like, if you don't do the thing that I want, this will be released to the press, which he also does at the end of Fletch. So I mean, there's a lot of Fletch that gets dragged over into this film. Whether it was in the book, I don't know.
It does feel like he's reaching for the success that he's previously had, doesn't it? And then we're kind of introduced to Nick, aren't we? He's at a desk, and he's definitely been to a tanning salon, but he looks a lot like a mixture of Ron Burgundy and Harrison Ford, is what I kept thinking in that opening shot. But in this film, we have an invisible man who later on, the villain of the piece, will describe as being invisible before he became invisible. Yet, in the opening couple of minutes of your film, I'm seeing a successful businessman who everyone seems to like, who's quipping and kind of having fun. It doesn't really correlate, and it really threw me.
Yeah, he has his own office. He has a secretary. He's a member of an exclusive gentleman's club.
He gets the girl straight away as well.
He even says it when we're introduced to him. He's on the phone, and you know he's booking his skiing lodge, and he says, let's put a king-size bed in there, because you never know. So he's...
This is where it is, as you mentioned before, an ego piece as well, I think.
He can't allow himself to be meek or put upon or kind of a little bit defeated. When we're talking about other 80s comedy guys who tried to get out of their lane, there's a Steve Martin movie called The Lonely Guy, which is, I think it's an Arthur Hiller directed film, but they're kind of going for like a Neil Simon sort of, you know, neurotic type comedy, and Steve Martin plays a lonely guy, and there's this whole kind of subspecies of lonely men stalking the streets of New York, and he allows himself in that to be kind of, you know, beaten down, bit pathetic. He's still funny, he still gets laughs out of it, but you would have thought that something like that, immediately for what the plot is trying to say about invisibility, yeah, you can't really have the kind of quick-witted alpha male arsehole, really.
I thought we were definitely going to get a Groundhog Day or a Bruce Almighty or a Liar Liar, a kind of comedic film which has a moral tale to tell about a character who learns to change after receiving an extraordinary power. Like this opening setup where he's like this brash, successful businessman, I'm like, I know where this film's going to go, and if they nail it, then this will be really fun. But unfortunately, Chevy Chase is totally the wrong actor to tell that story that they eventually try and tell, which is of this guy who is introspective and is lonely and needs affection.
It does seem by the numbers to start with. I'm the same, Gully. I thought the same, and I figured that his character was set up for development and all of that. But I said it at the very beginning, it's a very uneven film.
When he's in the Gentleman's Club, it kind of feeds into this idea that he's a bit of a loner, but then he goes to this exclusive Gentleman's Club where it's full of successful businessmen, and he meets his friend George, who throughout this whole film just wants to set his wife's mate up. That's all he wants to do, and I love it. He's just constantly got these eyes like, hey, come over.
I've got a Daryl Hannah. Do you want it?
I've got a Daryl Hannah.
She's over here. In true Rewind movie podcast tradition, I decided to age check Chevy Chase and Daryl Hannah at the time. Chase, 49. Do you want to have a guess at Daryl Hannah?
26.
I think a little late, maybe 30.
She's 32, okay. So it's not the most egregious. It's not Tommy Lee Jones and Anne Hesh. But,
it remains the gold standard of what the fuck were they thinking.
That is the gold standard for the attempt of old and young. I do like the way that Carpenter kind of gets there. Listen, I don't think they've actually got much on-screen chemistry, but the way that it's shot gives you that impression, especially when it cuts to the two, where it's just the two heads on the outside of the frame and they're just sort of spouting things that they like. It's a really quick shorthand way of kind of saying that these two are again on.
I hate TV.
Me too. I like music.
I love jazz. Hate weightlifters.
Narcissists.
Love skiing.
Love the ocean. And the woods.
I love blonde hair.
Love garlic.
I think Carol's testament, like half the film, she's acting against nothing. And I think she really sells it. I think she does a really good job.
I've always liked her from Splash for obvious reasons, but I think she's great. Wow, she's a mermaid, dude. Ariel is hot.
I think she brings a lot of splash into this, though. She's got she's definitely a really likable screen presence, and I think the film's a lot better with when she's on it because she draws you in. She's definitely a bit magnetic and
she's weird, which is good.
She's got a whimsical quality. She likes cheeseburgers, and she's exotic, and she's smart.
It's that thing of when you had Meg Ryan on Top Gun, you know, when she came in, you like her very much, and it's the same here with Daryl.
And she is stunning as well, like, just looks incredible.
Which is why I don't really get why she went with Chase straight away. Straight into the bathroom!
Yeah, there's a couple of lines. There's one where he makes a prostitute gag.
Oh, let's not do anything cheap. All right, what'll I owe you? Or something. It's always quips, and it's always comebacks, and it's always, like, shtick. And if they're going with, like a noir kind of hard-boiled thing, then that would make sense, but it's just, they're really frothy. They're a bit throwaway.
What are we doing?
I hope it's foreplay.
We should get back.
Yeah, we should get back.
Let's not do anything cheap and meaningless.
Okay, what do I owe you?
You couldn't afford it.
I actually thought that Daryl Hannah was going to be a kind of femme fatale. I thought she was going to end up being like turning on Nick. Did you guys ever get that, or was that just me?
That would
just
have been
wishing.
That would have honestly been great.
I really didn't get that at all.
Only because she like lights up the room. She's in this white dress. Her surname is Monroe. I think it's Alice Monroe. And I just thought how interesting it would be that she would end up like siding with the villain.
She had no cause to. He's not an invisible man.
Oh, I know, but I just thought maybe, like, I don't know, for her next documentary, something. Like, if she turned him in because she wants to study him herself and feel, just something like that. But it ended up not happening, and she ends up just becoming a very conventional, for the time especially, love interest.
No, it's that single trope from the time is, here's the love interest. It makes the lead actor look good because she's beautiful and, you know, he wants to be made to look good. Off you go.
I wonder if Ghost, you remember Swayze and Demi Moore? I wonder if that had maybe a little bit of a part to play, because some of the jokes that later on that Chase will do, I'm thinking when he's in the beach house with the guy who's like looking like he might rob it, and then he does the boo or the get out of here, kid.
Hey, dickwad.
That's all straight from Ghost. So I kind of wondered if that maybe loomed large just because that film made just so much money, and it was only 2 years previous.
It's one of the few echoes that it has with another Carpenter film as well, I guess, that the sort of genre film protagonist male gets together with a regular human woman, like from Starman. Although the perspective is very much flipped. So in Starman, we're kind of following Karen Allen, and she's our protagonist, and Jeff Bridges is, you know, a spaceman. But it's their kind of, their connection is the thing that kind of saves them both. And but this doesn't really carry the same amount of weight as that.
No, nor does it in, say, Big Trouble in Little China, where you've got a lot of the issues that we're going to probably discuss in this film does come down to, does the director and the act and the lead actor have the same vision for the story that they're trying to tell? And say something like Big Trouble in Little China, where you've got Kurt Russell and John Carpenter, and Kurt Russell clearly trusts John Carpenter's judgment and obviously thinks, you know what, you're not going to make me look a fool, and we're actually going to do something interesting about this archetypal white male action hero in this kung fu setting. And I just think if Chevy Chase was serious about becoming a dramatic actor, then he should have just trusted the person that really knew what he was talking about, which is John Carpenter. And I think
you're right in that, like, it is a lack of trust. Because if you look at times where actors have sort of subverted their kind of ego and their persona to a director who knows what they're doing, if you look at like Bruce Willis in 12 Monkeys or something, kind of undercutting the smug action hero stuff and kind of being really vulnerable and sad and weird, and it works for both of them. You know, it elevates the film and it's a great performance. So yeah, you don't really get that.
I find Chevy Chase's acting in this just almost unreadable because he's so placid, and he is completely. So I've no idea what's going on in his head.
I think you're right, because he's clearly trying to like short circuit his instincts to go for the laugh all the time, but he's not replacing it with much.
No, not at all.
No,
he's not introspective.
Not at all.
No. And when you've got something so lively and energetic as Daryl Hannah, that is bringing real, you know, emotion to the screen, I think. And he's just a brick wall. She's bouncing off, really. Even his hangover acting the next day is not very good.
But yeah, so a hungover Chevy Chase stumbles into a tech firm. What I like is that we're never really told much about it whatsoever. And Patrick, I can only imagine you were fucking thrilled to see who was delivering this lecture.
Oh, I'm glad you noticed. I'm glad. Did Galley notice? I wonder. Dr. Bernard Watts, Jim Norton, Bishop Brennan. I've got to kick Bishop Brennan up the arse. Don't call me Len, you little prick. Jim Norton, man. Yeah, could believe it when I saw him.
I didn't recognize him at all. Obviously, Jim, I knew him from the crew, but yeah, no, I did not spot him at all.
Oh, I leapt up when I saw him.
He's in a rush,
but
man.
I leapt up when I saw Sam Neill's name in the credits, because I had no idea. Some nice surprises in the cast in this film. And Jim Norton adding his thespian chops to it.
He doesn't have a great deal to do, but I mean, he brings a shouty Irish gravitas, and it's very welcome.
going back to the accident, I do like the way that it is just a pure goof. You know, it's just some coffee being spilled on a computer that creates some fireworks, which then it's like an anomaly that can't be replicated. And I do like that, because it just means that then the film doesn't need to muck about with any pseudo science. It can just be like, this will. Do they say that there's some nuclear material in the building and that
maybe,
is it?
They just go,
yeah, that's it.
Because anything you could try and come up with would just be dumb as fuck. So it's.
But doesn't he say, well, there's a great line where he's like, I want my molecules back.
Yeah.
I think it sets us up with the pace of the film as well, because it's quite a quick paced film.
Mm, at this point, it is rattling through.
Boom, introduce character, introduce her, he's hungover, bang, now he's invisible.
Yeah.
And this is great, isn't it?
We're then introduced to Sam Neill in a kind of pretty forgettable scene, but it immediately tells you everything you need to know about this guy.
He really loves throwing people off buildings in foreign hotels.
Yeah, there's a little offline remark about what he's been doing in some foreign country with some dignitary. He's like a CIA, but it says he's an operative, but is he paid by the CIA, but he's not a part of it? I always feel like his team are sort of not mercenaries, but they're not elite either, Christ, but
what's Black Ops? Is that a thing where you're on operations, but you're not supposed to be?
I think they're set up as the CIA, aren't they?
And what I found quite ironic is obviously Sam Neill did audition to play James Bond. So I saw this character as just like an evil version of Bond. He's sort of reckless.
Or a Bond villain.
He's driven.
Yeah,
but he's like playing it like a Bond villain, but he's still got that suave. You know what it is? It's that gelled hair with the little thread coming down the eye.
The thing is, I don't think Sam Neill's got much to do in this film, to be honest, because I think the writing's not great for him.
It's true.
No, but he does what he can to make an impression.
Yeah.
It's just repetitive.
If it wasn't him, this character would be a nothing. The fact that he's kind of, you know, Sam Neill can get real weird, and he did with John Carpenter a few years later in The Mouth of Madness. He can get really weird when he has to, and you can just see like the edges, just around the edges of his portrayal is like a barely contained kind of mania.
Well, I think it's his second scene that I like the most from him, when I'm skipping just over the accident and when he faces off with Nick Halloway, and he's instructing his men to circle him. I think Sam Neill did some really good stuff in that face-off there, because I think the film has some really good moments where the actors are playing against nothing and their performances are pretty good. And Sam Neill doing that when he's talking to Nick Halloway and explaining and trying to double-cross. I think that's where Sam Neill really brings his quality.
I love the repeated gag of like him always being off eyeline. When Nick's in his office and he thinks he's knocked him down on the floor and he's pointing down straight in front of him and it's like, dude, don't screw with me, and Chevy Chase is literally right next to him on his left.
they all feel like the moments that a real Carpenter touches, don't they? There's another one about the running gag with them shooting, missing and hitting innocents in the back of the neck. every time, it just got a laugh out of me.
Jim Norton gets in the back of the neck as well.
Yeah, it's so good.
In fact, when Jim Norton gets in the back of the neck, I swear he leaps in front of Nick. Face
he does,
on.
Yeah.
And then he gets it in the leg.
You can see in the scene in Jurassic Park, the famous scene with the kid where he's like, show a bit of respect. He's basically doing the same thing in this, where there's something about Sam Neill, even though on Twitter he seems like a lovely man, but he's got a little devil in him, hasn't he?
Well, my dad was convinced he was the devil for many years.
Really?
Honestly, my dad was scared of Sam Neill when we were.
Did
growing
he watch?
Up,
did he watch like The Omen? Possession?
He watched Event Horizon.
An Event Horizon, and he was like, "That man is possessed."
Did you see in the chat that Tobolowsky and Sam Neill have, where they say that they need to get to I can't even remember the name of the company, the Magnoscopics or something, but that it's in Santa Mira, which is the fictional town from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And subsequently, mine and yours favorite film, Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
Halloween 3, I was going to say
it. Yeah, there's a few Carpenter touches, isn't there? The taxi driver from Big Trouble in Little China. There's a couple of other smaller roles.
And himself.
Oh, John Carpenter, he's the helicopter pilot in this.
Yeah, he's one of the... Yeah, I spotted that one too.
He's showing off because he can actually pilot a helicopter.
Yeah, he can. Cool. God, he's bloody. He's another Cameron, and he do everything well. bastard.
I just love that. I didn't know it. It was you, Devlin, who told me that he wrote his own scores, and I just was right. I was oblivious to that. And that always amazes me. Like Clint Eastwood when he writes his own scores as well. I love that shit. It's great.
I can't help but feel like there's a lot on the cutting room floor in this film. And I do wonder if there was more CIA stuff that maybe there was a few more scenes with Sam Neill that maybe threw a bit of shade or at least gave him a little bit more motivation than...
Or maybe those scenes were just similar shit, which is why they're not there, because it's just monotonous motive.
But to me, that feels like a Carpenter piece, because he's always been someone who places himself slightly outside. And I just think about like him coming off They Live and even Halloween. He tends to be quite pointed with institutions and with authorities, and the CIA are quite an easy target for this, because they're basically shown to be bumbling fools who have got nothing but nefarious motives, and that's it. There's nothing good that comes from
them. Maybe it was there in other drafts. Apparently the majority of the Alice character, as far as I'm aware, that was added later on because they felt that they needed more of an emotional hook. I've not read the book. The book, though, may explain.
So it was
why...
more of a Hitchcock man on the run.
I think so.
Story then.
What I did learn from the book was that it was written by a first and only time novelist called H.F. Saint, and he was a financial analyst, which is why his lead character is a financial analyst. And also like the character, if you notice, the character of Richard is, I think, the same thing. And then
he's a broker,
that's it. And then he says, "You're a broker, yeah, but only until my novel is finished." And then, H.F. Saint made enough money off this to just not do anything anymore. I think he got like $4 million or something, and didn't bother writing another book. But maybe there was a lot more of, like you say, that kind of man on the run, like a constructed, you know, set piece to set piece to set piece, and they hollowed a lot of that out so that they could kind of force in a more emotional through line with the relationship with Alice.
It is quite a tight film anyway, though, isn't it? It's quite a pacey film. It only really slows down to explore that relationship between the two of them on the beach. That's when it kind of...
It grinds to a halt, though, at that point, though.
It does,
You mentioned it before, Patrick, and, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful sequence.
The Swiss cheese building.
When it wakes up, that effect with the building, just how creative, how imaginative. And I wonder, Devlin, if this is the kind of thing that you as a child probably were like, this is fantasy stuff, isn't it? Because we haven't really talked about it, but the idea of being invisible is like, it's definitely a kid's thing, you know, playing hide and seek. And what could you do if you were invisible? Obviously, most of the time, we'll talk about Hollow Man, but it seems to be that male adults tend to go down the sort of skeevy route. But as a child, you just think about the endless possibilities of, you know, you could do whatever you want. And I think even in the film, they mention you could go see whatever film you want to see or go to any ball game, whatever. But this building, how clever, and it looks amazing.
It is.
And the most amazing, the best thing about it is when you get the POV wake up and you see it, you are confused, like as he is, which is great for the audience, because there's
when he wakes up and he says he was in a nightmare and nothing made sense. It's like it's exactly what it is. It's really crazy.
You have to work it out, don't you? Like, what the fuck is going on? And then you figure it out. It's just it's a really wonderful visual thing. That set is incredible, and it's physical, and it's amazing.
I love that they're putting like orange tape around all the invisible walls, so you can see the edges of the building. And
there's a cool effect of them, you know, like standing on the ground and scanning it, but underneath them it's concave, and it's really cool.
I think this is the stuff that really, really, really struck me when I was a kid. It's all these little creative decisions like this. Well,
do you want to talk about the visual effects for a bit?
The ones that really stand out to me are this one. This whole sequence is fantastic. Yeah. There's later on when he's smoking, and you see the smoke fills the lungs and then exhales. And right at the end, there's a very last shot where the smoke that he exhales blows back and just gives you the very, very, very shaded outline of his face.
Yes.
As he's talking, and it's like...
It's a reference to the 1940 Invisible Man Returns, I think it is.
Oh, right.
They do that effect, but with real smoke.
Yeah.
And I still actually have no idea how they did it. But it looks better in this. There's a few direct nods to the old Universal Invisible Man films.
Yeah.
And that's just one of them, but it looks great. I'm surprised you're not mentioning it. Maybe we'll get to it a bit later. But I also love the sort of Spielbergian rain sequence as well, which is kind of magical.
I think my favorite is the makeup, though.
The makeup's insane. And like it allows for the sight gag when he wipes off a bit of his mouth. The film's quite meticulous with its detail, with those things and those laws and stuff. There's when he takes off the bandages to reveal himself to her, you get to see the other side of the bandages in the back of the head. That's a real, really impressive effect for the time. And
it is. It is.
That took me by surprise a bit because I was really stunned by that.
The same year, you have T2, Judgment Day, and ILM and the same team. Yeah, they go in. They had more money for one, and I think also John Carpenter, director for Hire, versus James Cameron, who is just a meticulous engineer. They create the T-1000, and then a year later, Spielberg used the same technology to bring dinosaurs to life. And it kind of, unfortunately, the film doesn't really get the same recognition, because I was even thinking about like Twister, which is not a good film. I enjoy it because it's kind of fun and goofy, but it's pretty. It's pretty rubbish.
It is, and
people still, people still talk about the effects in Twister, but they should be talking about the effects in Memoirs and Invisible Man, because this is groundbreaking stuff.
There's, it looks amazing. When he's jogging on the beach.
Incredible. That's great. Just
it's silly because there's a whole sequence before it when he's talking about, I need to eat invisible, clear food so I'm not seen. And then he jogs on the beach in clothes where he can't be seen, which is really silly, but the effect is unbelievable.
I think it's the presentation of it as much as anything else. It's knowing when to withhold it, and just every now and then you do this one thing and it's really, really impressive, but it's never, they don't dwell on it too much. I don't feel like they're ever doing things just to do them to show off that they can. Like when she's painting.
Oh, I don't know. The running on the beach.
Okay, yeah, that one is. That's just a visual gag. But when they're doing the makeup onto his face, and he's got the sheet wrapped around him, and he's literally just a hovering face, and he looks like the comedy tragedy mask. Like there's and his eyes are missing, and his mouth is missing, and you can see the back of it. It's like a real it's one of the few times where there's a really kind of a real emotional core to it.
Yeah, there's that sequence as well when he's running away from the CIA after he's bumped into Jim Norton and he's taken the trousers off mid run and undressed it. That is
I love the very obviously mechanical trousers. They're really funny. Like it's that sort of stuff. These kind of absurdist visual gags. There's I think like you say it's a little frustrating. The tones just never mesh. They sort of fight against each other, because if you could just push everything up, just bring the energy levels up just a little, you'd have this fantastic kind of mishmash. Like you're allowed to be funny in a chase film. It would be nice to see a little more of that. Although there are some very good visual gags.
The one blight in that whole building sequence stuff where the battle lines are drawn, Sam Neill's actually a villain after him, and we start the chase, is the voiceover, which started fine as in to set a film noir mood, but it eventually started to really grate on me and ended up just feeling like audio description, because he ends up just saying stuff like, I picked up the phone, I couldn't make the phone call, I then went over to the mirror. We're watching him do this.
I had to think what was real and what wasn't. Where was my hand? I couldn't see my hand. Oh, God. What had happened to me? I needed help, but who? I had to call somebody. And then I knew. It wasn't just the building. It was me. Jesus. I walked over to the mirror. I was right. There was no reflection. My body, my clothes, everything was gone. I was invisible.
I think you're probably right that it was probably just that the pace of it just lagged. Like it's a we've all spoken about that. It's this beautiful and really impressive and really weird scene, but yeah, just a dude walking around in silence during a really pivotal moment where we, yeah, you're probably right. He's not giving us panic. He's not giving us like existential dread. He's just sort of ambling around. What do you think about the decision to make to actually have him on the screen half the time?
I thought that was actually quite clever. For whatever we say about Chevy Chase, he's the star of the film. I mean, I think he got paid like $6 million for this. You're not going to pay him $6 million to just
wow,
do
really?
An audio performance.
Money?
Yes, I believe. Yeah, it's crazy. You're going to need to see him on screen. I guess the problem is that when we do see him on screen, he gets outdone. He gets out Buster Keatoned by this little known actor from New Zealand. Like when he does all the physical stuff later on, I was like wishing that was Jim Carrey. Someone who just had a bit more energy and a bit more timing. You know, when he's trying to put his hand in the sleeve.
Yeah.
I was groaning. I was just like, oh, this is not funny.
Well, the time that he excels in it is when he gets hails the cab to San Francisco with the drunk guy.
Oh, the Weekend at Bernie's sequence. I did find that funny.
That is a really funny sequence.
But then I love Weekend at Bernie's.
It's a really funny sequence. Like you just said there, the physicality. It's actually a different actor that we're referring to, but the physicality.
I know. It's not Chase, is it? It's the other guy. It's brilliant.
It's bloody funny. I was cracking up at that. Because when he drags it,
you're completely diagonal.
It's really good. That's the funniest scene in the film for me, though. That was the one that got the most laughs from me.
So the first 15, 20 minutes, I'm with the film, even though I think tonally it's slightly a bit of a mishmash. Then we have the park sequence, which I really loved, which brings me back up. But in between that, we've just got someone moping around. And I'm not going to lie, a bit bored. I was thinking to myself, like we've already said, that being invisible, kind of like a childhood fantasy. Why aren't you having much fun with it? And they have a montage where he rescues some old lady's bag.
Oh yeah, which is another good gag.
It's a good gag, but why aren't we getting more of that? Instead, he's just sort of moping around.
That gag's designed around him moping, though, isn't it? Because he's almost nonchalantly bored by it. And the whole point is he doesn't want to be invisible.
Yeah.
So, but it doesn't come across well enough. And again, I think it's performance, and I don't think it's well written.
They go for stuff. They got that little bit where he's standing next to the hot dog cart and he realizes that he can't eat anything.
But actually, I didn't get the boredom until he got to the beach, Scully. I was all right until then.
Just before then, he has his dream sequence, of course, where...
Actually, that dream sequence...
I quite like it, but it's also very much, it's a Chevy Chase movie. Remember, things that Chevy Chase likes include tennis, blonde women with large breasts, and the prospect of Chevy Chase being applauded when walking into a room just for existing. Because he does it in Fletch as well. When he walks into the newspaper office in Fletch, everyone does the old fucking Casey Ryback. Hey, Fletch is here. Fletch, everybody, come look at Fletch.
I was flabbergasted. I've got to say, this was one of the most narcissistic things I've ever seen. And again, later on in the film, his friend even describes him as a narcissist. Apart from that dream sequence, we've not seen it. To me, I'm watching Chevy Chase. I'm not watching Nick Holloway. It could have been Holloway. Ooh, different film. But no, instead, it's just Chevy Chase on screen. And I can't believe that John Carpenter...
He didn't
get final cut on this. There's no way he has.
And I don't think he got much input into Chevy at all, I think. I think Carpenter definitely has a visual style in the film. And I think it's directed solidly and...
His scene construction and I think the editing is like it's not flashy, it's not choppy, it's not in your face. It flows. Like you say, the pace sags because of story problems, but as a film it's pretty fleet. It does kind of, it moves along at a nice pace.
But we are coming up to our favourite character in the film.
Yeah.
Who, Dick?
So great.
Oh god.
Richard! So I'm just gonna ask you now, which British theatre actor are we gonna sort of subscribe that Richard is channeling? Because I had a bit of Jeremy Irons and a bit of Julian Sands, but the voice straight out of Family Guy.
Family Guy, that's what I wrote down.
Yes. Oh, I'm ready to have sex now.
It is. I mean, it's outrageous. This is what Americans must think that we are like. So when they go to, I don't know, Hull, they must just get horrified.
Like you said about Family Guy, you associate his character with New England rather than San Francisco. So he's a very, he's just a weird archetype in there for, I don't know, it's obviously playing up to the money in the background that they all have. But he's... But then we get another really strange, out of the blue joke on the beach, where Michael McKean prematurely ejaculates
right on Ray Romano's wife.
And this is where I started to think to myself: nine-year-old Devlin.
I thought that was hilarious.
And we've got a premature ejaculation.
I think that's.
Where did that come from?
Does he say like?
Well, I think this is probably where I.
Doesn't he say, give me
10
minutes? Yeah,
just look at the moon or something.
Oh, that is such a great line. Just look at the moon.
Yeah, that it's weird that Michael McKean's character gets chipped away at so much, you know, because we don't really know much about him. I guess he's just supposed to be like Nick's kind of frenemy, kind of obnoxious guy.
He actually has good intentions, doesn't he? Because he comes to his aid at the end for good moral reasons. Mm. And
if you had that sequence, but you didn't have like Richard being weird and Michael McKean prematurely ejaculating, what would you have? Because we've already said the film's not going very deep. It's not really. It's not mining the territory of like this is what it's like to be, you know, invisible and lonely. So
Devlin, can I forcibly disagree?
Go on then.
Because actually, even though the beach house is where the film grinds to a halt, it's actually got one scene which I thought was like, this is the film that I'd be really interested in. When Chevy Chase is hearing what other people think of him, it's the one moment where I was like, you know what? Despite the fact that I'm not a big fan of you, I'm sympathizing with you. And I just thought, how interesting would it be to... has got an idea of what they think people believe they're like, and actually it's the complete opposite. And again, it was feeding into this idea that I thought at the beginning of the film, which is, here's a guy who's obnoxious, who's arrogant, and is going to come down to earth and make a change because he realizes that actually he's a bit of a dickhead.
But he should have been more Scrooge. It's the Ghost of Christmas Present, and it should have been that.
I think Carpenter's into it because we stay with it. It's not flashy, but it's really funny.
I spoke to a little pencil pusher at some government agency I never heard of. He asked me the same sorts of personal questions about Nick the SEC did when Charlie Randolph got busted.
A lot of confusion over at Shipway in Whitman. A guy's been working there for 10 years like that suddenly disappears. Roger Whitman's got auditors over there day and night looking to see if anything's missing.
Do you really think he's a thief? Didn't strike me as the embezzler type.
Knowing Nick, he probably came here to shack up with somebody's wife.
Hmm? Yeah, honey, if that's all it was, he would have called me.
Listen, why don't we just change the subject? Wherever the hell he is, I'm sure Nick would love to know that we're talking about him.
I think Calloway got in a lot of trouble, came out here, got himself nice and loaded, and just walked into the ocean one day.
Oh, come on. Nick's way too narcissistic to kill himself.
He'll probably wash up on the shore one day, all bloated and eaten by crabs.
Richard? How can you say these things? I thought you were Nick's friends.
It's just, I don't know. I got a real funny vibe, like he's dead.
All builds to that fucking great gag where Richard just says something like, Nick, are you here? What does he say?
He says he feels like he's passed away. He doesn't feel like he's there anymore.
I've just got this crazy feeling like he's dead.
He's dead. And then he stands up and he pulls his trousers down and he's got the tightest budgie smugglers. And it's brilliant. They should have explored this.
A bit more poltergeist.
I just felt like I was actually getting a bit of character. Mm.
Christmas Carol stuff. It should have been like that.
It should have been more of that. But they literally, the one scene... And then
it just has the jealousy with her. That's all it developed was his jealousy of Richard over her. Even though Richard has that great line with the champagne. I was saving this for when I read my first novel. Brings that champagne.
Oh, and then he starts. That's it.
Just,
my wife left me 3 months ago. I'm a mess.
The way he just like jumps on it, I need you.
Did any of you also think at the beginning when the building that had been caused to be partially invisible, you know, when it fully becomes invisible and disappears and it's this big thing, big visual thing that distracts somebody and everything? I thought that was telling us that he only has a certain amount of time while this lasts.
You would think, right?
Yeah. Yes, Patrick. I thought that was what was going on. I thought it was a ticking, but that went by the wayside.
A ticking clock, yeah.
It's nothing.
No, I think that would have, and that would have really upped the dramatic stakes, because then he would have had to have found a cure or done something. Yeah. And maybe even, like you said, again, it plays into that It's a Wonderful Life Scrooged element, where, right, you've only got so many, you've only got so many
the
days
consequences
on this
aren't high enough, are they?
So you're going to have to make a change. Yeah. But it does, again, doesn't go there, because whether it's Chase doesn't want to go down that route and he actually just wants to stay in his lane, because he says he wants a more dramatic role. I think it's there. The building blocks are there, but the film never commits. And I don't think it's Carpenter. It's got to be Chase, right? It's got to be the studio. I don't know. It's just such a missed opportunity.
But there is a towards the end of this little beach house sojourn, there's another kind of, we get reminded of just how quickly, like, John Carpenter can conjure up an atmosphere with just one shot. You know, when they're over at the second beach house, the grey beach house that he's moved into, and the helicopters are all kind of swarming in to Michael McKean's house, and Chevy looks through the binoculars, and you've just got smoke billowing through a hot spotlight, and like, and then the dogs just start running across the beach at them. Immediately, that's like a little, it's another one of those kind of jolt of energy moments. Like, you remember that this film is actually supposed to be kind of exciting.
Yes. Yeah. No, I do think he's working with not a lot, Carpenter.
Well, he's fighting with Chevy, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. And I think I did a little bit of research on the set. I think I read an interview with Carpenter where he described actually working with Chevy Chase and Daryl Hannah as being a nightmare.
And Daryl Hannah?
We haven't mentioned it yet, but there is a very strange HBO documentary hosted by Chevy Chase on the set
about
of
tennis.
The film, which is... No, it's on the set of the film. He discusses skiing, though. And it's got a weird, weird bit with Mel Gibson driving around the studio, which is just the strangest thing. And in that, you get a glimpse into how they create the special effects. You also get a glimpse of Carpenter directing on set, which is actually, for any kind of cinephile, is quite invaluable. But what you do see is you see him get a bit short with them. There's one when they're in bed together after they've had invisible sex, and she sort of says,
"Any comments? Any comments on the technique there? As that is your forte."
Well,
how many PSI was he?
Should have been normal. Should have been normal. I think I.
So would his semen be invisible as well?
Oh, it's a good question.
Well, I mean,
his beard is invisible because his beard is growing.
Yeah, I'm going to say no because it's not something that has been external and entered in. And they kind of do set up the rules, don't they? A little bit with anything that gets digested, becomes invisible. So I'm going to go with it's invisible jism. But you see Carpenter get short with them on set. He's like, shut up, let's shoot. Yeah. It's just quite an interesting insight. Right. You don't get much, but you get a little interesting insight. And we'll link it to the show notes, to the YouTube link, so you can watch it if you're interested.
I want to watch that. I missed that.
It's only 30 minutes, but it's quite an insight into Chase and the mood of the set, because he gets a little bit spiky with some of the crew members as well.
You can see Chevy Chase literally directing other actors in the middle of the scene, like right there on set, telling other actors what to do, basically blocking
it
all
out. After the beach house, we go pretty full on, don't we? Like to the end.
I think we're in like 20-25 minutes left, something like that. I think we are rattling through towards the conclusion
when they do get on the train. Carpenter's kind of pretty restrained in this as well. Like you said, his scene construction is very not functional. Makes it sound like it's not flashy. It's just not flashy. He's not drawing attention to himself. But there is one particular shot which just had me creaming, and it's the bit where Daryl Hannah's going through the doors
and all the ladies screaming,
and you see Sam Neill's, yeah, well, Willie Beeman, and you see Sam Neill's reflection, and it's awesome.
Yeah, that is great.
I was
isn't
like,
it?
Oh, that is such a, and it's a Hitchcock shot. Oh, it's amazing. I was like, that is great.
We're about to come up to blackface.
Oh!
Every time this film gets a little lull, they pull me back in.
God,
the blackface is outrageous.
God damn it. Late '80s, early '90s. Oh, in fact, the entire '80s and most of the '90s. So. He did. It hit that one's worse.
If you are easily offended by Chevy Chase's short stint as blackface, then please do not seek out Soul Man, which is currently on Amazon Prime. Where he does it for the entire film. It's just crazy.
Watch C. Thomas Howell in horrendous blackface makeup, yelling like really offensive racial stereotypes in front of Leslie Nielsen.
The thing is, it's so odd because it's unnecessary. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't need to.
You just see the baseball cap down.
He's got like is it a turban? He's got the beads on.
They don't even look in the cab, so it doesn't matter. They just love doing it. That's the problem. They really just love doing it.
I don't know the man. You've seen him live in concert, but that doesn't strike me as a Carpenter decision.
Oh, no.
Because
no.
I just don't think he would go.
Well,
there.
Again, you've got the Fletch thing. Like from Fletch, he keeps getting into like unnecessary disguises and that. I've not seen Fletch Lives in a long time. None of the ones that he does in Fletch, the first one, are anywhere near as bad as this, except for the bit when he has a basketball dream sequence. Do you remember when, like, he has a dream that he's a member of the Lakers and he's got a large Afro wig on? And I just think they love doing it. I just think they think it's inherently funny.
And then we're basically in it. Then we're in the final act, and
because they catch him immediately, so the subterfuge is very short lived, and then and then you get the disembodied head of Chevy Chase running through the streets, which
is actually quite funny.
Yeah it is. It's and then washing himself off, and then that's it. I do like the effect that they do of after he gets wet and he falls into the dust on his jacket, and then he gets into the elevator. It's another one of those times where like a really, really subtle effect, which is some dust clinging to an invisible jacket.
Yeah.
It just looks really nice. Like it's well done. You can see the light coming through the grate in the thing, and it's really realistic. And it's another time when they went subtle when they could have gone quite big, and it's really helped out the scene. But yeah, you just end up with it reveals too quickly that Chevy Chase is holding the blazer out.
I totally agree. I actually, watching it again, looking at the way that the scene's constructed, I was like, no, you save that for when Daryl Hannah's searching for the bodies. Like, I would play it completely as in they fall and you think both of them have gone. Feels like such an unsatisfying ending. He's not been a great villain, but I mean, he deserved better than that. And even the one-liner, what's he say? Ole,
you son
what
of a bitch.
A lame-ass line. Yeah. You couldn't have come up with something better than that. He's supposed to be a comedian.
That is a damning indictment.
It just felt really powder puff, that line, this ending. And you're right, it's so quick. Like, I think his boss then comes in and says, oh, we lost his mind, we just couldn't help him. Get rid of everything. No one needs to know anything. It goes to Daryl Hannah and just says, forget everything. Mm-hmm. And then that is it. And then well, what? They walk. Nick reveals himself to her. A little bit too casual on the walk away. I mean, I wouldn't put my arm around him just yet, but hey-ho. And then
the ski.
One of the other things that Chevy Chase likes to do, which is to ski. So, of course.
And they're running the credits right over it as well. It's like, it's like the film is done. This is postscript.
Well, I hate to leave it on a bit of a downer, but yeah, that is it. That is Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Yeah.
So, Devlin, it was your choice, and hopefully we've tried to be somewhat balanced.
Yeah.
So, I ask the question. does Invisible Man hold up? And would you recommend it to our listeners? And yeah, did you waste your time with it when you were 9 years old?
I had a lovely time watching this multiple times when I was a youngster. So I mean, I don't regret that. After all we've said and all of the very, very valid criticisms about the tonal problems and the to be honest, considering this was a film that I only watched a lot because apparently I was well into Chevy Chase's shtick at that time. He is kind of the weak link, but I still think that this is a really frothy, light, easy watch that I would be happy to watch again. There's enough craftsmanship in there. It mostly kind of floats along at a relatively nice pace. It gets bogged down here and there, but I have like a whole category of films that I like to watch, which are just sort of like a lovely bit of Sunday afternoon background stuff. And this fits the bill really well because there's bits of it which are great and you can key in for them. And then there's bits where it drifts and you can just sort of drop out, check your phone, have a biscuit, and then you can come back when it gets better. And for that, I'd recommend it. Like if you've never seen it, give it a watch just because it's the work of one of the greatest living filmmakers in my shitty opinion. And as such, it is worth seeing what he can do. It's a frustrating and slightly disappointing, and there are moments and there are opportunities for it to be something quite special, and it's not, but it is still mostly entertaining, and if nothing else, has some exceptional kind of. On the cusp of the very best of like physical practical effects and of the kind of the new generation of visual effects that came through afterwards, it's for that I recommend it. How about Patrick?
Yeah, I hadn't seen it. You know what? I'm not very familiar with National Lampoon's or Chevy Chase really. My first impression of him was Three Amigos, and I remember really enjoying that when I was younger. But Chevy Chase has always been. Someone I feel like I'm a lot more unfamiliar with than you guys, but I do largely agree with you in part, Devlin, that this was quite an easy watch and I found it quite harmless. We didn't speak about the CIA agent leering over the girl working out in the park, but on the whole it was yeah, that fucking creep. But it, you know, it was. Oh, this is such a bad sentence to say, but the film is okay. It's fine. And you can come for the, and what I would recommend is the visual effects, because I was kind of blown away by a lot of them. And Daryl Hannah, you'll come for, and Sam Neill, despite him doing his best with some poor writing and her acting against nothing. I felt frustrated and I did want more from it. And it's a shame when you see films like this that are, you know, where the problems are and it could have easily ironed out. And if ego hadn't been in the way, imagine what you could have had. But it in part comes with a warning that it's not great and it is a missed opportunity. But there was large parts I did enjoy and some of the originality of it. You know, I've always... forever now take away the image of that building, which I thought was astonishing, which is great, and thanks for recommending it for this. So Gally, which end of the spectrum are you on?
Yeah, no, I think I'm probably somewhere in the middle. I think Carpenter delivers on the visuals and the feel of the film. You know, he harkens back at the beginning to this Hitchcockian Man on the Run style. But in the end, I think the film ends up fighting with itself. You know, is it a chase movie? Is it a character study about what it might really be like to be invisible? Is it a love story? It ends up being kind of all of them and none of them at the same time. So I end up kind of being left quite frustrated with it. I feel like Chase is deeply miscast. And I believe there is an entertaining film exploring like the troubled character who saw themselves differently to how others see him. But it's just not this, and they only touch upon it in that one scene, which was my actual, outside of the visual effects, my favorite scene in the entire film. So I think if you enjoy visual effects driven films, especially the early in, like the early incarnations, the opticals, and the sort of the birth of CGI, then you'll get some real magical moments, including that building, like you said, incredible. And I think if you're a John Carpenter completionist, then by definition, you should definitely see this one, because as you said, Devlin, he is a true master of cinema, and you should always try and seek out some of the misses as well as the hits. And yeah, I think it could have been a great film. And unfortunately, I know I sound a bit deflated, but I think it had real great potential. And I do wonder what that original script was like and what is on the cutting room floor. So all I'm going to say is hashtag release the Carpenter cut. And that's it. But I recommend it. I actually do. I think it's worth 99 minutes of your time, like you say, on a Sunday. And I think, you know, the humor's not that raunchy. I think kids could easily get a kick out of it. So, yeah, I think I will. Mild recommendation. How's about that?
Oh, it's all right, isn't it? I'll take that.
Yeah. Right. That leaves us to Patrick.
Oh, my goodness.
You have the honor of picking the film that we do for...
Yippee!
Merry Crimbo 2019. Well, so what are we going to do?
I'm going to go with something of the season, Gally.
Oh, thank God.
And I'm going to pick our first animation.
Oh.
We're going to discuss The Nightmare Before Christmas, please.
Oh,
good one.
Oh, amazing. That is great. Yeah. It's our first Burton as well, isn't it? Oh,
wow. It's not Burton.
Selleck,
oh,
it's
of course mistake. It isn't. No, I make the mistake every time. You know what? I'm doing terrible, aren't I, tonight? You know, Mike Reed, Tim Burton. Where does it go next?
You're now envisioning Tim Burton working at the Green Vic.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, that would make it... I'd watch his standards again.
The barber shop down the road.
Get out of our pub, you weird goth.
Wow. We took Tim Burton to Albert Square. This is... crazy.
No, but I haven't seen it in a long time, so I'm excited.
Oh,
but
good.
Genuinely,
because
normally my Christmas films over the last few years, I've just been sticking with It's a Wonderful Life followed by Jingle All the Way, which is a weird double bill, but that's just where I've been feeling the groove, so I'm happy to go back.
Do
to
you know,
some
Jingle All the Way is my grandma's all-time top three favorite Christmas films.
That's great.
That's crazy.
I know. I love it. She has it on DVD and we watch it every year.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, that's made me legitimately very happy.
Yeah.
Oh, we love you, Grandma. I hope she's listening to this one.
But let's make sure we get that before Christmas, okay?
I guess what? That leaves us to say our goodbyes. What we will say is that for those of you that wish to seek out Memoirs of an Invisible Man, it's currently on Amazon Prime. There was a Blu-ray release, but it's really scanty on special features, as in there's a 5-minute documentary.
That's a shame, because there's a US release that people always talk about, which is Shout Factory. Shout Factory is, I guess, kind of similar to... I guess something like Arrow Video, which is, yeah, they're putting a lot of effort into films which you wouldn't have thought would really deserve it. But apparently that is a very good Blu-ray set. So maybe if you've got a multi-region Blu-ray player, you can seek it out.
I guess that leaves us to say our goodbyes then, gents. So it's Gally in Glasgow. I don't have a funny quip to say, which is in keeping with our lead actor for this film. So... I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Some very, very harsh shade being thrown. Mike Reed, you're a twat. This is Devlin in London. I'll see you next time.
Because we had Jim Norton in the film, which is great. Don't call me Len, you little prick. It's Patrick from London. See you later.
I'm the invisible man. I'm the invisible man. Incredible how you can.